Welcome to Explore the Space. We're digging into healthcare issues that matter most. Our guests and conversations mine these issues for perspective and answers. There is a gulf between healthcare and our communities. This is the place to talk about it. Now here's your host, Dr. Mark Shapiro.
Bob, welcome back.
It's a great pleasure.
You know, we talked about the book in our previous podcast, and there was one section of the book that I really wanted to get back to a little bit. You make reference in about the middle part of the book to when you were the course director and moderator for the 1990 International AIDS Conference. Talk about what you went through, what we kind of all went through, and what that experience was like, because I think that there are some very interesting themes that permeate your book. I think that there are some very important ideas that come out of that experience from the 1990s and the 1980s that I think certainly resonate today a little bit. So I really am glad that you were able to come back. You have another book from, I believe, published in 1991, The Fragile Coalition, and that's your summary of your time planning and promoting and trying to protect that conference. Give me a sense of what that era was like. Give me a snapshot of that time period.
Well, first of all, thanks for asking, Mark. History doesn't come up as often as it should, and I recognize now that the AIDS era is to my medical students today as World War II was to me growing up. I mean, it's hard to believe.
Which is hard to believe, I know.
It is. It's hard to believe how much it is in the rearview mirror. And I think in particular, AIDS remains obviously an extraordinarily important and tragic disease, but has a very, very different flavor to folks today where, it's a manageable illness it's not at all unusual to see people that are alive having lived with HIV for 20 or 25 years. And my friend Mark Smith liked to tell the story about this 71-year-old grandfather with HIV that he takes care of. And Mark says, I'm on more medicines than he is. And he every day goes to drop his grandchild off at school. I mean, these are inconceivable for those of us who lived through the formative years. So for me, I'll tell you sort of two brief stories about it, because I think it had two trajectories. One was my experience as a trainee and clinician in that era, and the second was having this remarkable opportunity to help put together the International AIDS Conference well before I was old enough or smart enough to have a right to do that. And so it was in some ways a coming-of-age story, and that's what that book was. When I was a third or fourth-year medical student, it was 1981, I was at Penn, and my attending, David Goldman, we admitted this young gay man with this terrible respiratory illness, and he developed respiratory failure and died. And David said to us on rounds, this thing is going to change the practice of medicine. It didn't even have a name
back
then.
Wow, that's amazing.
And we had this sense that there was something emerging, because you saw drips and drabs of cases here and there that just violated every norm that you had. You know, a young, previously healthy person would come in and crash and burn with an illness that we couldn't quite explain. And
this is not that long ago. Far away ago, right?
This was 1981, and the first reported cases of the disease came out then. I came to San Francisco for my residency in 83, so I was here as a resident from 83 to 86. And I wrote an article in the New England Journal in 85 called The Impact of AIDS on Residency Training. And it started off by saying, during my residency, I've seen more cases of pneumocystis pneumonia than pneumococcal pneumonia, and more cases of Kaposi sarcoma, the cancer that AIDS patients often get, than breast cancer. And sort of a reflection on how transformative it had been in my training and formative years. It was an amazing era, and there's a part of it that I'm not that proud of, but I think is real, which was we were scared. The tragedy was obvious. These were young, healthy people, the prime of their lives being struck down. But it was also incredibly exciting. And that sounds inhumane to say, but I can tell you it felt that way, that we knew we were in the middle of something earth-shattering in the history of medicine, and that the opportunity to just discover stuff was myriad. I mean, everywhere you looked, in my residency cohort, we had people who became the national experts on, will you get AIDS if you get stuck with a needle from an AIDS patient? I started doing research on how AIDS patients did when they went to the ICU. These were opportunities that the residents would never have in any other field, but it was all unfolding before our eyes for everyone, whether you're a senior attending or a newbie. So that it was an extraordinarily interesting year. I think, you know, seeing what people have gone through recently, some of my colleagues went to Liberia and dealing with Ebola, that sense of it's, you know, it's horrible and you really wish it would go away, but it's also in a way, you know, a rare opportunity to touch humanity and make a difference. And like the folks who went into the Ebola regions, we didn't know that we weren't going to die from this. I mean, when you went and visited a patient in the room at the time, we did not know that this wasn't airborne and that we would not be struck down by it. So the acts of bravery on the part of the clinicians, on the parts of patients and family members, it was really quite staggering, incredibly rich. And I wish it didn't happen, but in some ways it was a remarkable part of my career. The conference itself, I was a fellow at the time, and UCSF had signed on to become the sponsor of the International AIDS Conference, which at the time was sort of going from place to place every year. This was the sixth one in 1990, and I was 28 or 29 years old and didn't really know, you know, the only thing I've ever administered was I was chief resident, so I kind of knew how to run a residency program, but had nothing. And found myself in the middle of this conference that drew about 15,000 people and 1,500 members of the international press, and probably more interestingly was a conference like no other in that because it was the central conference in this remarkable disease, and AIDS had become a new kind of disease where patients were getting involved. Patient activism was becoming quite prevalent because it was striking largely the gay community that was feeling like no one was paying attention, which I think was largely correct. I ended up running not only a standard scientific conference, but also a political circus. And early in the days of planning it, one of my mentors said to me, you really should take notes about this. You're going to want to write about it when it's over. And so every day at the end of my day, I would dictate a little note about what had happened at the end. The book I wrote in 1991 was essentially my experiences living this, and really through the lens of the conference, some observations about the nature of AIDS and the nature of disease and the nature of what it means to be a clinician and a patient in the modern era.
It's so great that we have that because, first of all, like you say, you know, you use the word exciting, and I think all of us understand what you mean by that. It's having a sense of moment. And when that is occurring, we need to have an understanding of the gravitas of what's happening around us and be able to, if nothing else, at least embrace it. And then to have a book like this, you know, of course, we want to have primary documentation. It's one thing for us to discuss something, you know, many years after the fact. But anytime we have primary documents, that was drummed into me as a history major. Secondary documentation is just fine, but you want the yellowed paper with the smeared writing. So for us, this is what we have from the 80s and 90s, and this is what we can draw from. You know, you mentioned the issue of Ebola, and that was actually one of the things I really did want to get to, because we want to find the things that were happening 20, 30 years ago, and I want to connect them to what comes up for us now. And I think all of us remember well, and we're going to probably recognize again in the future, the furor that came up when we began to deal with Ebola within the United States, and obviously Western Africa has been struggling with it for a lot longer than us. The piece that linked together, I think that really connected with me pretty profoundly was, and I want you to give us a little bit of context on this, was the issue of, I think the term was opportunistic discrimination. In the United States, we had travel restrictions that changed the way people who had HIV were or were not allowed to enter the United States. This came up again just a few months ago. There was very real conversation about whether people should be allowed to enter the United States if they'd even been in an area with Ebola. The furor, I don't think, was the same, of course, but it did change. I mean, American citizens are now limited into the number of airports in which they can enter the United States. But take us back a little bit. Take us back into the late 80s and just describe that issue of the travel restriction and the impact that it had on an international level with respect to your conference reaching all the way to you writing letters to President Bush at the time.
Well, not just writing letters, but you know, having a protest march through the middle of San Francisco as part of a scientific conference. I mean, that was not on my agenda when I was asked to run this conference, that we'd be organizing a protest march with several thousands of people.
Yeah, your residency prepared you for that, right? You knew how to do that from residency.
I think we had a similar protest once when they shut down the cafeteria too early and we were on call. But yeah, I was not brought up in kind of the world of activism, and this was a hand that we were dealt. We were planning an international conference, and in the sort of during the planning stages, the U.S. government decided to ban HIV-positive people from coming across our border. And so all of a sudden, we're running an international conference, and if you have HIV and you wanted to come to this conference, you no longer could. And for the AIDS activists in the United States, they saw this as being wrongheaded and morally wrong and so egregious. And we sort of felt like, you know, why take it out on us as a conference, but you do what you can do. And they began, not just they, but sort of everybody began an international boycott of our conference. And so we were faced with a set of circumstances where this conference that we were planning, which, you know, was a big deal and we thought quite important, and also people had spent a lot of money and time on it, could have just gone away, could have been aborted because of this. And we had a decision to make, which was whether to just kind of retreat or to join with the protesters and use the conference in some ways as a vehicle to make this point. And that, of course, became tricky because the U.S. government was partly sponsoring the conference and the Secretary of Health was speaking in the closing ceremony. But at the end of the day, we felt it was the pragmatically right call, but also the morally right call to be on the side of the protesters. The protests, I think, you know, reflecting on the Ebola issues, there are a lot of tricky issues in how a society reacts to an infectious threat that does cross borders. And, you know, there are parts of the decision-making that really are kind of epidemiologically driven and should be driven by science. And there are times where you do restrict people's movement and travel, and that's kind of a scientifically reasonable thing to do. There are other times where you're getting into hysteria and stereotyping and scapegoating. And I think the Ebola feel in, you know, over the last 6 months had a little bit of that. I think the feeling that we had in the late 80s and early 90s was this was most of it, that the evidence was really quite clear that you could not get HIV from being next to someone with a disease or on a bus with them, which I think was part of the difference with Ebola, where there was legitimate fear that you could get it from being in close proximity with someone. By the time the U.S. government enacted that restriction in HIV, it was pretty clear how the disease was transmitted, and you would not get it from casual contact with someone. But the second was the U.S. government at the time had a very clear track record of discrimination on this issue. I mean, the fact that the president of the United States did not utter the word AIDS in a speech until more than 40,000 Americans were dead, is all the evidence you need that the government was not paying sufficient attention to this. And it had everything to do with the fact that it struck the population it struck. It struck gay men largely in the beginning.
I remember learning that fact actually when I was in college, and I was reading And the Band Played On by Randy Schultz, one of the most influential books of my life. And when I read that, it hurt. It's a sad fact to look back and think of that. And I think that, you know, we can talk a lot about the lessons that we learned, but I think we do need to always have the expectation of leadership to address imminent threats to human lives and lives of our citizens. And I certainly don't want this to sound like a polemic, but we need to expect more than that from the highest levels of our leadership.
It was profoundly disappointing. And I think if you're growing up today and you see the, you know, obviously there still is discrimination, but in the 80s, you know, today's response to gay marriage, for example, would have been inconceivable. I mean, the evolution of our society on that issue is profound. In the 80s, the amount of discrimination was remarkable, and really, you know, not just from the folks that you thought might be discriminators. It was really quite prevalent in all walks of society and kind of socially acceptable to discriminate against gay people. And so when this disease hit that population, I think it markedly colored not just the federal response, but the institutional response in general. On the other hand, part of the theme of that book and an article I had in the New England Journal in that era was that this was really the first disease that had hit a disenfranchised but politically organized group. And so it led to the degree of AIDS activism that came out of that was actually, to me, quite heartening and profound, and I thought had general lessons, because I thought here you had a group that was being ravaged by a disease, but a group that had a sense of identity, a sense of being disempowered and knowing that unless we fight for ourselves, no one's going to pay sufficient attention. And that ultimately, I thought they were really setting a model for disease-specific activism and for patient engagement. And so back in the, you know, back in the day, as I wrote in the book, before there was Google, I mean, many AIDS patients knew more about their disease than their doctors did. And when I invited AIDS activists to serve on all of the conference committees, that was not just a political maneuver to co-opt them. In many cases, they knew a ton of stuff about what was going on, and they made a tremendous contribution. So in some ways, that was my early introduction to this notion that, you know, the physicians and the scientists are up on a pedestal and these, you know, these dumb patients will just accept what we tell them, that that was really wrongheaded and that patients could really make a tremendous contribution if given the right information. And I think that's part of what we're seeing today, not just the activism, but I think one of the things that's happened because of the internet is the democratization of expertise. And that, of course, provides challenges to every industry that has had a hierarchical relationship between the experts and the non-experts. But it's a good challenge. It's a challenge that I think ultimately we work our way through and we end up in a better place.
And we've talked about that a little bit before, and you talk about it in your new book, The Digital Doctor. There's the line from before that you had in the Fragile Coalition about the empowerment of patients is now a part of the sociological landscape. But I remember, you know, you and I have talked about this before, and obviously it's something we talk about a great deal, how much our patients are able to learn about their own, you know, personal health and medical records. There was a quote in the Fragile Coalition from Paul Boneberg. And in that quote, he said, there will always be a fundamental conflict between patients who empower themselves and their doctors. Now, that was from 1990 or maybe 1989, but we are still left with how are we going to reconcile that? It started then. It is just as open and, I think, fraught with question now. Have we made progress, do you think, from when he said that to you to where obviously it impacted you, it got into your book, to now? You know, we're now a couple of decades later. Have we evolved much in that reconciliation process?
I think so. You know, I'm sure you have your own sense about that, but it feels like, particularly among younger generations of physicians, the idea that, you know, that I am on high and that sort of arrogance and haughtiness that comes, I think, with, you know, I am the font of all information and I will, you know, deign to tell you, patient, what you should do. I think that has eroded quite a bit, and some of that is specific changes within medicine, but much of it is just broader sociological and historical changes. I think the democratization of expertise, the recognition that agendas that are co-developed by, you know, the experts and the non-experts tend to be more robust and probably more correct than ones that are developed independently from, you know, in a top-down way. I think that sensibility has you know, more to do, I think, with Ralph Nader and Google and other or the broader trends in our society than anything specific with medicine. I think that people are much more comfortable with that today. It's not at all a foreign concept for when I look at our medical students today. They embrace this. The level of arrogance that I think was embedded in medical training a generation ago, I think they reject. Doesn't make it easy because, you know, we all have to renegotiate who we are and what we do, and there will be conflict when, you know, the expert thinks so-and-so based on their best reading of the scientific evidence, and the non-expert, or someone for whom this is really important because it's their life, has a different read. And you see this conflict sort of play itself out all over the place. I think the measles vaccine issue is one crucible for that conflict, and that has a little bit of a unique twist because it's not just you make a decision about yourself, but there are others that are affected by the decisions that people make. To me, it's a very exciting era. Part of why I wanted to write this book was I think those issues are incredibly interesting, and the fact that medicine has just recently gone digital changes the conversation in new, fascinating ways that I don't think we've thought through deeply. You know, one of the things, patients have had a right to have their charts since HIPAA in 1996, but, you know, try to go get a paper chart from a hospital medical records department. The minute the chart went digital, all that stood between a patient and their chart was a password. And that kind of changes everything.
Right. So you mentioned, you know, this issue of other issues that can galvanize. You know, in reading the Fragile Coalition, just remembering that era. I mean, that's when I was growing up. I remember I would go to the Moscone Center where the conference was held. They had a huge baseball card collecting conference. It was like I think it was called the National Sports Collecting Convention. And my friends and I, you know, our parents would drive us in every year. You referenced that area called the Pit, where the protests were going to be kind of, where the protests were going to be held. I remember the pit. I remember that big vacant open space there. There was this amazing swirl, though, of social impact, political impact, the press, physicians, patients, advocates. Nothing has happened like that where all of those things have intersected to that level, but it's going to happen again. I think it's going to happen in my lifetime.
One would think. I mean, I think that in some ways, you know, I grew up in the 60s, but sort of in the late edge of the 60s and was, you know, grew up in a pretty quiet suburban place and kind of missed it. You know, I was in 1968. I was 11 years old, so it was a little before my time. But I think, you know, what I saw in planning that conference was the closest I had seen to the 60s. And, you know, again, when you're in the middle of it, it's there's parts of it that are unpleasant and you kind of wish everybody would calm down and just talk to each other. And then there are parts of it that you say, wow, that's, you know, that's right. What we are, the position we have put this particular group of people in is not right. And the only way it's going to change is with some level of activism that's going to, if it's going to work, it's going to make people pretty uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And certainly we're going to see that again in other domains. And I think the electronic piece of it, that will clearly be part of the new formula. I mean, you see this now with ISIS, that the ability of groups that want to make a political and social statement to take advantage of this electronic connectivity, you know, it creates a megaphone that didn't exist in 1990, certainly didn't exist in 1968, and I think it will color all activism going forward.
But there's parts of that era that I think are going to be a real challenge for us now. Obviously, my generation of physicians, of students, of, you know, parts of the human experience. You know, in the 90s, physicians were dealing with threats of violence. You were dealing with, you know, having to have a police presence. You were dealing with large, incredibly powerful political bodies that would leverage their weight. Where does the tenacity come from? Where does the insight sort of come from? Because when this happens again, whether it's measles, whether it's Ebola, obviously we're never going to have a handbook for it, but I do think that we need to have some sense of understanding and context so that we can handle things where the best possible outcome takes place. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, your sensibility is very much that of a history major. It's fun to hear, and it strikes me as being quite correct, and yet societies tend not to be that smart. I mean, we tend to be more emotionally driven. And you would say that in the Ebola response, people would have gone back to the history books and looked at the early years of AIDS, and what did we get right and what did we get wrong? And the answer is, yeah, maybe a little, but if you're the governor of New Jersey and you're feeling an existential threat and you're feeling your constituency is pushing you in a certain direction and feeling that doing something may help your presidential candidacy, I don't think you spend a lot of time looking at history books. I mean, I think you do what you feel like is the thing to do at the moment.
That's what this sort of discussion, I think, is. That's one of the whole reasons I wanted you to come back. And these conversations need to happen because these sorts of things, we have this ability now. We can leverage these things out. People can access this information for free, and we can spread it very quickly.
I have to say, Mark, I think that the level of spread, I mean, doing a podcast that didn't exist 20 years ago, is part of it that's quite heartening, which is although the electronic connectivity presents a mechanism for fringe elements to have a megaphone and be in some ways heard disproportionately, it also provides a self-correcting mechanism for folks that would not have been able to have their opinions heard, you know, but for a letter to the editor of the newspaper, now, you know, coalesce on Twitter. And I think in some ways that is what we saw in Ebola. I think it's actually quite interesting that the early panicked response that was largely not scientifically driven, I think in the old days probably would have won the day for a longer period of time, but for a social media generated or at least facilitated response from the scientists and from other interested parties that said, you know, this is wrongheaded. There's no evidence it's going to work, and here's why it might not. Mm-hmm. And then the pushback, I think, actually ended up mostly winning the day. So, you know, I think that part, that issue comes through in The Digital Doctor as well. You can't be too technologically optimistic that it's just wonderful we're all connected, but you also can't be a Luddite and say, oh, it's terrible we're connected and, you know, go back to the days of pen and paper. you know, it's a tool and it's a mixed bag, and if used for good, it's really, really good. And I think, you know,
yes,
I'm more optimistic than pessimistic when I think about these kinds of opportunities when they hit in the modern era.
I think that that is a theme that you have to come back, and we're going to have to explore some more, and we're going to have to continue to dive into this book. This book is about 25 years from its publication date, so I will entreat you to, with all of your free time, come up with the 25th anniversary edition and re-release it, because there's things in this book that need to come back out. We need to discuss them more. But again, thank you so much for coming to join us. Really appreciated having you.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Explore the Space. Visit us on our website, explorethespaceshow.com. And please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at ETS Show. And you can email Dr. Shapiro by writing to mark@explorethespaceshow.com.